With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Waiting for next year. What's going on, everybody? WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. I'm Craig Lindell. You know me, although you might not remember because it's been so long. Sorry for that. It was a traveling week last week with a holiday, and now I am back. It's been tough to get things scheduled this week, and certainly that part of that is the Thanksgiving hangover, but we're back, and I have a guest today who will be on shortly, Will Burge. Before I get there, though, I want to tell you about Patreon. We've started to really ramp up what we're doing over there. We're going to do some exclusive giveaways of items on Patreon to the people who support us directly. That's patreon.com/WFNY, patreon.com/WFNY. And for the people who are supporting us there, we have opened it up to give them the ability to ask special questions. We're going to have Terry Pluto on the podcast to talk about sports and promote his new book. And we're going to do that shortly, and I've opened it up to the Patreon folks to not only are they going to have a special allotment of books for the giveaway, but they get to ask questions. So those are the kinds of things that you'll be able to do if you sign up over there. So that's patreon.com, patreon.com/WFNY. And, you know, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but it's a little extra bit of support that we can use in trying to achieve our goals. We're almost up to 40 people, so it'd be really great to get up to 50 and even beyond that, but certainly 50 would be a nice short-range goal. So head on over there, give us some support if you can, share it out, let us know if there's something you'd like to see us do over there. We're going to try and make it a special experience for you guys. And now I'm going to make the podcast a special experience by welcoming in Will Burge. And there's Will Burge. You there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Will Burge of WTAM.
I love when we do these because you ask me to come on, and I don't even ask what we're going to talk about. You could literally be asking me questions about anything, like birthing habits of leopards in Africa. I have no idea what we're going to talk about.
And I'm sure you would come up with an opinion on it. You might ask a follow-up question, and then you'd come up with something. That's kind of where I wanted to start, though. So, you know, you're at WTAM. You've been a sports guy for a long time, but you're not, like, strictly sports anymore.
No. I think anybody who only focuses on one thing is, you know, kind of putting the blinders on other things that are happening in the world. And there's certain aspects of covering sports that I've gotten really sick of, the kind of the TMZ style of sports reporting. I really can't stand that. And then just some of the NFL especially, and some of their hypocrisy with, you know, domestic violence, some things. Things just rub you the wrong way after a while, Craig. And you go, you know what, if I'm going to be pissed off about something, I might as well be pissed off about the government and talk about politics and everything else too.
Yeah, it's just interesting that you found a place where you can actually kind of do both things. But you end up kind of being a bit of an outcast with the rest of the personnel at WTAM, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. I think, obviously it's I don't know if anybody knows this or not, but it slants a little bit right over there at WTAM. it's a little more of a conservative talk station, obviously, with the nationally syndicated shows they have. And even the local guys, you know, Triv went out there and was full blown, you know, campaigning for Trump the entire time. And, you know, Glenn, while not as far as him, certainly right leaning as well. And where I think I lean left, but I try to stay very much in the middle because I think that's where the sane people, or at least most of them, land. And I think there's so many interesting issues. You know, we were at a public funding for sports stadiums debate just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I understand people who are vehemently against or are completely for it, just as I do in almost every situation. But I think there's compromise always to be had, which is what really fascinates me about talking politics, is that 90% of people who are active in talking politics want nothing to do with a compromise. But 90% of people who are out in the real world who aren't actually actively calling shows or hosting shows, they do like compromise, and they do like finding a sane solution in the middle, because I think that's where most people actually think about things and land with their opinions.
Well, and that was something you mentioned. You know, we were at that debate or forum, whatever you want to call it, on the public financing of stadiums and infrastructure. And I think that is one of those cases where, you know, we ended up going out afterwards and had talked with some people. And I think there is a lot of room for compromise in that. But it's like it's all one way right now, where it seems like the public gets the short end of the stick in terms of owning, in terms of financing, in terms of improving these things. And it benefits. It's too far in one direction. But the politicians seem all too happy to have the one-sided relationship, don't they?
Yeah, and here's the crazy thing about it, and I've actually been in emailing back and forth with Len Komorowski, the president of the Cavs, who we talked to, or who we listened to on that panel that night, who obviously was defending their position of, hey, look, you know, this is a public entity. You know, we asked for the money. They're giving us the money. We're doing great things in the community. We're building this into a place that attracts great events like the RNC and all the concerts and all the things it does. And I don't think anybody's debating that side of it. We're hoping here in the next week or two I get to sit down actually with Len and get a little deeper into it with him. Because I don't think anybody's debating that side of it. What our buddy Peter Patakis at Cleveland Browns was trying to say is, all right, if you're going to ask for this money, show us why you need the money. I think that's really where it gets hazy, because if someone's going to ask for the money and they're just going to be given it, then they don't really need to show where it came from. You know, I think that falls more on the politicians than it does on the Cavaliers or Dan Gilbert. You know, people say that, you know, Dan Gilbert makes plenty of money to fund his own stadium. But if he looks at this as, hey, this is still community owned, and if you guys are going to pay me the money, of course I'm going to ask for it. So that's where it falls more on the county council, Armin Budish, and those guys who, instead of just saying, yes, please, anything you need, here's the money for every business who wants to come into town, taking a step back and saying, look, these guys aren't leaving. They can't go anywhere. You know, the Cavs aren't up and moving out of Northeast Ohio, out of Cleveland. That's just not realistic. Yes, we need to keep that stadium competitive along with other arenas around the nation to continue to attract these events. But let's figure out a compromise here. You know, I was just talking to the lovely Jenna last night about this exact issue. And what I would like to see is, I don't really mind public funding for arenas and stadiums and things of that nature, but let's also make them invest in the area, because we keep being told about the Gateway District and what it's brought to downtown and how that was the catalyst for the rebirth of downtown. Well, now it's kind of fallen behind the times of other things that are happening out there. We've heard the promise of this Nucleus project across the street, which is never going to happen. I think anybody who has ever talked to anybody anywhere near related with that project knows it's probably not going to happen. So let's invest some more money actually in that Gateway area and bring more business there. I'd like to see more retail downtown. So I don't necessarily find a problem with publicly funding stadiums, but I do think that, you know, the county should be more of a position to negotiate their side and say, all right, well, we'll give you some money, but how about we bring in something that brings in more revenue, not just in the stadium, because you're making money not only on the team, but also on concerts and everything else that's brought in there.
Well, and I don't think it's controversial to say that Dan Gilbert has done a pretty good job of investing in the city. And of course, it's all it's a lot of self-interested stuff, you know, whether it's the casino, whether it's bringing Quicken jobs to downtown Cleveland. I mean, he's doing it because it makes good sense for him, for his investments and everything else. But in terms of reinvesting in the city, he's done a very good job. I think it is about finding that balance. And that was the other thing that we talked about after that forum, was that this issue is so much bigger than just Cleveland. It would be nice if Cleveland could be a leader in the conversation. It just seems like we're always going to be trailing the conversation and kind of let other municipalities fight on the front lines first.
Yeah, it's going to be a city that doesn't care about if the teams leave or not. You know, that's really where this battle is going to be. I don't want to say won, but that's where there's going to be a huge change in the way things are viewed in public funding, because public funding of stadiums right now is used as a leverage point. And a lot of this really started when the Browns left. I mean, you can go back to the Browns leaving Cleveland, and all of a sudden that created a rash of teams threatening to move their teams out of their cities. And before that, cities just didn't believe it. They said, oh, no, no way you're going to move out of here. But then once they saw the Browns leave Cleveland, they said, oh, shit, this could happen anywhere. You know, this could happen to any of our cities. So that put all the leverage onto one side, onto the ownership, onto the NFL, NBA, and MLB teams. And it's going to take a team or a city that just doesn't.
What's going on, everybody? WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. I'm Craig Lindell. You know me, although you might not remember because it's been so long. Sorry for that. It was a traveling week last week with a holiday, and now I am back. It's been tough to get things scheduled this week, and certainly that part of that is the Thanksgiving hangover, but we're back, and I have a guest today who will be on shortly, Will Burge. Before I get there, though, I want to tell you about Patreon. We've started to really ramp up what we're doing over there. We're going to do some exclusive giveaways of items on Patreon to the people who support us directly. That's patreon.com/WFNY, patreon.com/WFNY. And for the people who are supporting us there, we have opened it up to give them the ability to ask special questions. We're going to have Terry Pluto on the podcast to talk about sports and promote his new book. And we're going to do that shortly, and I've opened it up to the Patreon folks to not only are they going to have a special allotment of books for the giveaway, but they get to ask questions. So those are the kinds of things that you'll be able to do if you sign up over there. So that's patreon.com, patreon.com/WFNY. And, you know, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but it's a little extra bit of support that we can use in trying to achieve our goals. We're almost up to 40 people, so it'd be really great to get up to 50 and even beyond that, but certainly 50 would be a nice short-range goal. So head on over there, give us some support if you can, share it out, let us know if there's something you'd like to see us do over there. We're going to try and make it a special experience for you guys, and now I'm going to make the podcast a special experience by welcoming in Will Burge. And there's Will Burge. You there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Will Burge of WTAM.
I love when we do these because you ask me to come on, and I don't even ask what we're going to talk about. You could literally be asking me questions about anything, like birthing habits of leopards in Africa. I have no idea what we're going to talk about.
And I'm sure you would come up with an opinion on it. You might ask a follow-up question and then you'd come up with something. That's kind of where I wanted to start, though. So you know, you're at WTAM, you've been a sports guy for a long time, but you're not like strictly sports anymore.
No, I mean, I think anybody who only focuses on one thing is, you know, kind of putting the blinders on other things that are happening in the world. And there's certain aspects of covering sports that I've gotten really sick of, the kind of the TMZ style of sports reporting. I really can't stand that. And then just some of the NFL especially, and some of their hypocrisy with, you know, domestic violence, some of the things just rub you the wrong way after a while, Craig. And you go, you know what, if I'm going to be pissed off about something, I might as well be pissed off about the government and talk about politics and everything else too.
Yeah. It's just interesting that you found a place where you can actually kind of do both things. But you end up kind of being a bit of an outcast with the rest of the personnel at WTAM, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. I think, obviously it's I don't know if anybody knows this or not, but it slants a little bit right over there at WTAM. it's a little more of a conservative talk station, obviously, with the nationally syndicated shows they have. And even the local guys, you know, Triv went out there and was full blown, you know, campaigning for Trump the entire time. And, you know, Glenn, while not as far as him, certainly right leaning as well. And where I think I lean left, but I try to stay very much in the middle because I think that's where the sane people, or at least most of them, land. And I think there's so many interesting issues. You know, we were at a public funding for sports stadiums debate just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I understand people who are vehemently against or are completely for it. Just as I do in almost every situation, but I think there's compromise always to be had, which is what really fascinates me about talking politics, is that 90% of people who are active in talking politics want nothing to do with a compromise. But 90% of people who are out in the real world who aren't actually actively calling shows or hosting shows, they do like compromise, and they do like finding a sane solution in the middle, because I think that's where most people actually think about things and land with their opinions.
Well, and that was something you mentioned. You know, we were at that debate or forum, whatever you want to call it, on the public financing of stadiums and infrastructure. And I think that is one of those cases where, you know, we ended up going out afterwards and had talked with some people. And I think there is a lot of room for compromise in that. But it's like it's all one way right now, where it seems like the public gets the short end of the stick in terms of owning, in terms of financing, in terms of improving these things, and it benefits. It's too far in one direction. But the politicians seem all too happy to have the one-sided relationship, don't they?
Yeah, and here's the crazy thing about it, and I've actually been in emailing back and forth with Len Komorowski, the president of the Cavs, who we talked to, or who we listened to on that panel that night, who obviously was defending their position of, hey, look, you know, this is a public entity, you know, we asked for the money, they're giving us the money, we're doing great things in the community, we're building this into a place that attracts great events like the RNC and all the concerts and all the things it does. And I don't think anybody's debating that side of it. In fact, I think we're hoping here in the next week or two I get to sit down actually with Len and get a little deeper into it with him. I don't think anybody's debating that side of it. What our buddy Peter Patakis at Cleveland Frowns was trying to say is, all right, if you're going to ask for this money, show us why you need the money. I think that's really where it gets hazy, because if someone's going to ask for the money and they're just going to be given it, then they don't really need to show where it came from. You know, I think that falls more on the politicians than it does on the Cavaliers or Dan Gilbert. You know, people say that, you know, Dan Gilbert makes plenty of money to fund his own stadium. But if he looks at this as, hey, this is still community owned, and if you guys are going to pay me the money, of course I'm going to ask for it. So that's where it falls more on the county council, Armin Budish, and those guys who, instead of just saying, yes, please, anything you need, here's the money for every business who wants to come into town, taking a step back and saying, look, these guys aren't leaving. They can't go anywhere. You know, the Cavs aren't up and moving out of Northeast Ohio, out of Cleveland. That's just not realistic. Yes, we need to keep that stadium competitive along with other arenas around the nation to continue to attract these events. But let's figure out a compromise here. You know, I was just talking to the lovely Jenna last night about this exact issue. And what I would like to see is, I don't really mind public funding for arenas and stadiums and things of that nature, but let's also make them invest in the area, because we keep being told about the Gateway District and what it's brought to downtown and how that was the catalyst for the rebirth of downtown. Well, now it's kind of fallen behind the times of other things that are happening out there. We've heard the promise of this Nucleus project across the street, which is never going to happen. I think anybody who has ever talked to anybody anywhere near related with that project knows it's probably not going to happen. So let's invest some more money actually in that Gateway area and bring more business there. I'd like to see more retail downtown. So I don't necessarily find a problem with publicly funding stadiums, but I do think that, you know, the county should be more of a position to negotiate their side and say, all right, well, we'll give you some money, but how about we bring in something that brings in more revenue, not just in the stadium, because you're making money not only on the team, but also on concerts and everything else that's brought in there.
Well, and I don't think it's controversial to say that Dan Gilbert has done a pretty good job of investing in the city. And of course, it's all it's a lot of self-interested stuff, you know, whether it's the casino, whether it's bringing Quicken jobs to downtown Cleveland. I mean, he's doing it because it makes good sense for him, for his investments and everything else. But in terms of reinvesting in the city, he's done a very good job. I think it is about finding that balance. And that was the other thing that we talked about after that forum, was that this issue is so much bigger than just Cleveland. It would be nice if Cleveland could be a leader in the conversation. It just seems like we're always going to be trailing the conversation and kind of let other municipalities fight on the front lines first.
Yeah, it's going to be a city that doesn't care about if the teams leave or not. You know, that's really where this battle is going to be. I don't want to say won, but that's where there's going to be a huge change in the way things are viewed in public funding, because public funding of stadiums right now is used as a leverage point. And a lot of this really started when the Browns left. I mean, you can go back to the Browns leaving Cleveland, and all of a sudden that created a rash of teams threatening to move their city, their teams out of their cities. And before that, teams or cities just didn't believe it. They said, oh, no way you're going to move out of here. But then once they saw the Browns leave Cleveland, they said, oh, shit, this could happen anywhere. You know, this could happen in any of our cities. So that put all the leverage onto one side, onto the ownership, onto the NFL, NBA, and MLB teams. And it's going to take a team or a city that just doesn't care about whether or not the teams move to stop this and say, you know what? I mean, we just saw it in San Diego. They voted down the public funding of a new stadium down there. But sooner or later, someone's got to stand up and say, no, we want to know why you need this money. We want to see the exact deal that we're getting here, because if you're not showing your books, I get you're making a lot of money. Why do you need some of ours? And to circle back to what you said about Dan Gilbert, like I said, I think, you know, maybe it's not even in the Gateway District. You know, if you're going to give Dan Gilbert and $70 million to redo the outside of Quicken Loans Arena, that's great. But how about we use 10 of it He just purchased Tower City. I know he's got big plans for that thing. Why don't we kickstart that project and go and get it going a little bit quicker to try to infuse some more money back into the economy for next year and continue to build year by year as we move forward instead of just being promised things on the horizon about these big projects and then kind of waiting on our hands and seeing if it actually happens.
It's just crazy because I think we would find so much common ground among citizens, among leaders, among everybody, if we would just stop with the dumbest of all the conversation around this stuff. Like, you know, we heard some really silly things in that forum comparing stadiums to public roads. I mean, just a stadium is a stadium. We all understand what it is. We all understand the relationship between the people who operate there and the people who own it and what's good for who, you know, what are some of the other, comparing it to a public road was one. I'm trying to remember what some of the other really silly arguments were.
Well, one of them was that, you know, if you're jealous of, you shouldn't be jealous of the owner's profits when he was being pushed about, and this wasn't Len Komorowski, I forget the other gentleman's name. Was it Tom Kima? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, it was formerly of the Gateway Group, that the people who pushed to find out whether or not the ownership needs this money, they're just jealous of the profits. I don't think those are the issues. You know, I think obviously there'll be people on one side of this, all the way on one side, that say, no, I don't want any of my tax money going towards this. Those are billionaire owners, and they can pay for their own stuff. I think a lot of people in reality don't mind some of their tax money going towards this stuff. They just want to see some more transparency and see those teams invest within the community as much as, and I got to give credit as you did before. I mean, Dan Gilbert does. I mean, if you're talking about the ownership in this town, nobody here does it like Dan Gilbert does. So this is the tough one to push back on if there is one, because they do so well, not only on the floor, but outside of that arena. And Dan Gilbert's investing so much in downtown. I think the easier one to push back on, Craig, is the Browns. Anytime the Browns ask for anything, I know this is a crazy leap to connect, you know, funding, public funding to what they actually do on the field, but I don't think it's that crazy. You know, I think you're to uphold, to say, we're basically, you're saying we're blessed to have you in our town, right? We're blessed to have the Browns here, so we need to pay part of this money to have the team here. Well, what part of that bargain have you held up? Hey, you could continuously fix up a stadium, but a stadium that is housing the worst product in professional sports. You know, I'd like to see Jimmy Haslam and the Browns be held more accountable for the funds they're putting into the team. And not just because they're bad on the field, but because they're bad on the field and they have the most salary cap room in the entire NFL. So if you're saving $50 to $70 million every single season and putting a crap product on the field, you shouldn't be able to come back and ask for more Syntax money right now to fix up that stadium. How about use some of the money in your salary cap to even try to put a good team on the field, and then we'll talk about it. And I know that's a deeper issue, too, because then we start talking about the rebuilding of the franchise and stripping it down to bare bones. But I think in just the simplest sense of the terms, you're talking just dollars and cents, Greg. For a team like the Browns to come back and ask for Syntax money to fix something up when they're not even spending all the money they could be spending on the team they're supposed to be putting on the field representing our city, I think that's where the pushback could be a lot more firm here. It's tough to do with Dan Gilbert because they do what they do so well.
Yeah, and I can't even begin to try and speak on behalf of Jimmy Haslam, so I won't. What I will say is that I think it's probably still a little bit too early to see what kind of investment he'll make in the city. I think they've done a really good job. Hang on. I'm going to finish that sentence. I think they've done a really good job updating the stadium and making the best out of that kind of really boring stadium that they were handed. The operations and the way you get in and out, the ticketing and all that stuff is 1,000% better than what it used to be. And in this next phase, they not only have to, you know, rebuild the team so that it's a competitive product, so that it's something we actually want to watch, but we also have to see what they do kind of to their immediate district around them on the lakefront. Cause that's a place where if Dan Gilbert owned the Browns and he was in control of some of that property down on the lakefront, you got to think that he would be thinking of ways to add additional revenue, maybe a hotel, or I don't know. I have no idea, but that is what we're going to see from the Browns, and that's where Jimmy Haslam's going to kind of make his reputation as a member of civic society as well as just a team owner. And it's too early to tell.
I would agree with that. I mean, if you remember a couple years ago when he first bought the team, there were the concept drawings of all that area back there, and there was supposed to be a school put in, a park, housing, a retail area, like a mini Crocker Park type area. And I think, you know, I'm not sure, this is just me kind of hypothesizing here, but I think that some of the legal issues that Jimmy has on Pilot Flying J have gone through and already paying out, what is it, like $90 million to the government, $80 million in civil settlements, or maybe I'm flip-flopping those, but it's somewhere around $170 million total from their company for the rebate fraud scandal. I'm sure that's put somewhat of a, you know, that's thrown a monkey wrench into the gears of trying to get some of that stuff going. But if you're Jimmy Haslam, you don't have any, there's no goodwill for you right now.
No.
You know what I mean? I think something like that would go a really long way to show you're helping build downtown Cleveland, helping build something new here, and not just putting a crap product on the field. And I know that's the hottest of all hot takes is give us a good team and we don't give you money for your stadium. And I agree with you, the stadium looks great now. But at a certain point, we can't just keep going, okay, well, they're probably going to develop that, and at some point they're going to spend this money on the team. Some of those things actually have to start materializing.
So let's talk about the actual team itself, kind of parlay this into an actual sports conversation. The obviously, you know, the Browns decide to rebuild, and it's hard to argue tearing down a 3-win team that was kind of aging. But certainly, even with that goal in mind, the Browns can't possibly have thought that they were going to be as bad as they've turned out to be this year. And maybe it's bad luck. Maybe it's bad planning. It's probably a little bit of both. What do you make of the rebuild? And do you think that they can survive kind of carrying out their plan as they wanted to with a season as bad as what they're doing?
Well, I think that it's a walk the fine line of what they're trying to do is really tough. It's a balancing act that is very tough. We see it all over sports. And we saw it in Philadelphia where they tanked for a couple seasons, got a bunch of high draft picks. But when it goes too far one way, it's tough to pull it back out. You know, you can hit a skid heading the wrong direction off of this just as fast as you can hit a skid, you know, making you climb up the standings in your division as well. So I think what's happened is they tried to walk that line. I think it was a lot of bad luck and a lot of bad decisions that resulted in this. Look, the idea was, I think, right. I think you had to strip this thing down to bare bones. There was a whole bunch of dead weight here. I think we've seen some development of younger players. You could point to guys like Danny Shelton and Bodie Calhoun and some of these other guys that have shown they hit Terrell Pryor. I mean, you have to give the team credit for those guys if you're going to knock them for everything else bad they're doing. But when you fill a locker room full of guys that don't have much NFL experience, that's really where you're playing a dangerous game, because you're gambling at that point, all right, we're going to win a game because it's the NFL, and every NFL team wins a game, right? That's the gamble you're taking with all those young guys, and that's usually a winning gamble. But by just saying, all right, we're going to win just because it's the NFL, we can run with this young team. But look, people will tell you, even any win in the NFL is a tough win to get, because there's guys, there's professionals in the locker room that know how to do it. Well, I don't think there's many guys on the Browns that know how to do it. I think that was the biggest mistake they made. Well, I understand keeping all those rookies, I understand cutting some of the dead weight. Even some middle-of-the-range free agents that just have been around some winning before could really help the team. I don't think there's many leaders in the locker room. I think it's you know, kind of the blind leading the blind, if you will, with young players that don't really know how to win in this league yet. And if you go 0-16, I think there's been a ton of development made on an individual level. But you still go into next year with no one on your team knowing how to actually win. And I'm not saying they're never going to win a game again, because that's crazy. And obviously next year they'll probably win 4 or 5 games. Who knows? If they have a good draft and this team continues to develop, and maybe even more if they have an outstanding draft. But at some point, the guys who are here now, their growth is stunted, or at least there's a cap put on top of it in the ceiling, because you don't allow them to figure out that utmost important part of football, which is winning in crunch time at the end of games. Talent only takes you so far. There's guys who just know how to win at the end of games, and I don't know if this team's learning that right now. So, yeah, time will tell on this rebuild. I think there's probably a lot of positives that come out of it, but I think there was only so much positives they could have had because they never put veterans in that locker room and allowed this team to understand how to really win.
So this is one of the debates that we've been seeing all over social media and in our comments section at Waiting for Next Year. How much difference is there in your mind, or maybe you've talked to some players and you have a sense, how much difference do you think there is between going winless and winning one game?
Because
I actually I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I don't really know the answer either. And look, the Detroit Lions are not a good example because they've been a bad franchise for so long. But nobody even remembers that 0-16 season. I mean, we do because we laugh about Orlovsky run out of the back of the end zone, which ironically happened to Cody Kessler in the preseason for the Browns this year, if you remember. Those are the only two times I can ever remember a quarterback running out of the back of the end zone while still looking downfield to pass the football and taking a safety. And now they both might be 0-16 teams. But you don't really remember that. So I think the long-term effects are overstated for an 0-16 team versus, you know, a 1-15 team. But I do think there are some immediate effects, like, you know, just them snagging a win down the stretch. I think that sends young guys into next year with a hell of a lot more confidence. And I think it helps the franchise when they go into free agency and go, yeah, we had a really tough year, but look, we have these young guys, and they, at the end of the year, they're figuring out they're playing well. They're in games. They're learning how to win. I think it's easier to sell your team to a veteran free agent, which eventually you're going to have to sign at some point, if your team has shown signs that it can actually do it. As of right now, they haven't. I mean, they every week, Craig, we go into these games knowing every week that they're going to put together a quarter. Sometimes they put together a half, but they're never going to be able to put together four quarters. I think it's a really tough sell to free agents. So in the long term, probably not the craziest effect between zero wins and one win. But I think in the immediacy, I think the perception of the franchise changes just with that one victory, because you don't go into that infamy category with the Lions.
Was there one moment or one signing or one lack of signing that indicated to you that maybe these guys had no idea what they were doing? Because for me, even though it's not the most impactful player of all the ones who left, I found the really, really late cutting of Paul Kruger to be kind of the one that was like, I could just imagine those guys sitting around, their arms folded, going, yep, we know exactly what we're doing. And then being shocked when the team is now sitting at 0-12 and probably going to be 0-13. Yeah. So for me, it was kind of that, not that Paul Kruger was the best, but that was one of those late ones where it was like, what are you guys even doing?
Yeah. And I think, look, that's more of a message. Like, if you don't want Paul Kruger on the roster and you want to play younger guys, I totally understand that. I get it, but you got to cut him sooner, because that people know that, free agents know that.
He was cut August 29th.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even give him a chance to get a competitive cut. If he would have got cut earlier, he would have had a chance for a good contract with a team and probably have multiple choices to go to. In the end, it's almost like you screwed him over, like he did something wrong to you. And I think Paul Kruger, anybody who knew him in the slightest bit, knew he was a great guy here. He did a ton of stuff in the community. He played his ass off for this team, played through a lot of injuries here. And was it the right football move to let him go? Maybe. I don't know. But certainly it was terrible timing. And the other one, certainly, that everybody talks about, but it can't be overstated, is Mitchell Schwartz. And not even just the fact that they didn't re-sign Mitchell Schwartz, because once again, I could see maybe they really like a bunch of linemen in this draft. You know, they drafted two in the third round, obviously. They thought Cameron Irving was going to develop into something better. And they said, you know, maybe we just don't want to spend that type of money on a right tackle. Well, the way it was botched is really the problem. It's not the fact that you didn't bring him back, which is a huge issue in itself, but the fact that you offered him a contract. He said, okay, I want that contract. And you said, nope, never mind, we don't want to give you that contract. And then he's like, kind of like, you know, what the hell, man? Why did you pull the contract off the table? And then a week or so or 2 weeks later, whatever the time frame was, you go back to him and go, okay, never mind, we want to sign you again. At that point, he's a smart guy, man. He went to a very good college. He's got family that's in the NFL. He said, you know, go screw yourself. I can go somewhere better. I can win. I wanted to be a part of this rebuild. It's just bad business, Craig. And I think they stumbled, the front office stumbled a lot to the first what, a year and a half or 2 years or whatever we are now with Sashi Brown and then adding in Paul DePodesta. The problem here now is you can't get rid of these guys. Like, this is what you signed up for. You made this bet, and then you have to lie in it for at least 3 years. And I think probably more like 5 years. And I keep, and it's maybe just me crossing fingers and looking for a ray of hope at the end of the tunnel. I keep looking at the Raiders, and I keep looking at Reggie McKenzie and how god-awful he was at drafting the first couple years. And then the light switch clicked, and he got Khalil Mack, and he got Derek Carr, and they got some linemen in there, and they put some wide receivers, Amari Cooper, they put some wide receivers around him, and all of a sudden they're a damn good football team. And I don't know if they're going to make the run that everybody thinks they're going to make in the playoffs, but they're right there on the brink for the next couple years of being one of the better teams in the AFC. So I keep looking at them and saying there is a possibility in it. But the Browns have to stick with the plan for once. So you're stuck with these guys, and you have to hope they have a turnaround, because the first year or so hasn't looked that great.
Well, and it's a shame, because there's no way to have any faith in Sashi Brown, and that's not taking a shot at him. It just means he's got no track record. He has none.
Yeah.
And Paul DePodesta has a track record, but not in football. And so you're left looking at Hugh Jackson, and I think a lot of Browns fans still feel very good about Hugh Jackson. It's just a really hard thing because you want to have some hope, but there's nothing without a win, without – I don't think you can find anything looking between the numbers to give you this idea that, yeah, they're on the right track. They've got all the right people in all the right spots. And you're right. They're locked in at this point with Haslam's firing record. They can't really make a change for at least the next 3 years. You still there, Will?
Yeah, I got you. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good.
You got me now? Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm writing through Walton. You know, I heard you, and I agree with you. I think you are locked into these guys, and there is nothing to grasp onto at this point. Look, they knew they were throwing this year away. I just don't think they realized how poorly it was going to look when they did it. I think most fans knew this was a throwaway year coming into it. But as a fan, your heart still wants to win. So it's tough to actually sit here and swallow this whole thing. But this is going to be one of those things where they're judged years down the road on this stuff. And I know none of these guys really have a track record except for Hugh Jackson, which is putting a huge weight on his shoulders, probably an unfair weight on his shoulders. But this is the job he signed up for. I mean, Greg, go back to before week two when he was pounding on the desk saying, you hate me now, but you're going to love me later. You know, people thought I was crazy on the WTAM pregame show for killing him and saying he should save that speech. But how much better would that speech have sounded now, right now in the season, than it did in week two? In week two, everybody kind of rolled their eyes on it. Now, maybe it would have fired some people up. Instead, we've been hearing it all year. I just think the job, and for like it's been for everybody who's taken it, the job and the task of rebuilding this franchise in this situation with the history of how bad it's been since 1999 on your shoulders every single year and the passion of this fan base is such a larger task than anybody understands what they're taking on. And you can almost see in every regime when the light bulb goes on. And to give Hugh Jackson credit, he figured it out early. And I think that was kind of that little mini freak out he had where he's like, this is going to take a lot longer than I thought it was going to. But at least now he knows the situation at hand. He knows what type of work's actually going to have to go into it. Unlike a guy like Mike Holmgren, who just refused to believe that hard work was needed to fix the situation. He could show up at noon every day.
All right. Well, Will Burge from WTAM, I've got one last thing for you before I'm going to let you go.
Sure.
Another thing that we've been talking about at Waiting for Next Year a lot, and it might be a pointless question when you look at kind of the continuity of the Cleveland Browns over the long term, but for the rest of this year, while we do have to watch the rest of this season, if you're making the quarterback decision, are you going to put more tape on Cody Kessler? Are you going to make your decision on RG3 and try and see more of him? I assume we're not going to see any more McCown if the decision's up to you. What do you do at quarterback?
I think they know what they were doing with both those guys, but I think Hugh Jackson wants and desperately needs for himself to get a victory. So he's going to play RG3. Now, if I'm the quarterback and I'm in there, I probably would do the same thing. I think the whole you got to get as much tape on Cody Kessler as possible thing is completely overblown, not just with him but with any quarterback. They have practice tape. They have tape from this entire season. I think we have a pretty good idea of what Cody Kessler is. And, look, even if they decide to go and draft a quarterback first overall, let's just say they go take Mitch Trubisky, you know, first overall in this draft, which I know some people would freak out about, Cody Kessler is going to get to compete with him. He's not going anywhere. So he's going to have that shot next year. They're not just going to relegate him to the bench and throw a rookie in front of him. In fact, the job will probably more than likely be handed to Cody Kessler, and he'll be told, hey, carry this thing for another year or so before the kid's ready to go in there. So the whole you got to get more tape on him, I think, is overblown. And I think they know what they have in RG3. You can't trust them injury-wise. You know, maybe he's on the roster next year. I think it's highly unlikely. Hugh Jackson rolled the dice thinking, look, it's going to be a young team. I have some weapons on offense. If I can get one lightning in a bottle year out of RG3, we make a little bit of a run, and I can make some noise. I can turn this thing around quicker than possible. But look, we've all done that with projects in our life, right? You've looked at, you know, fixing a car, and you said, all right, well, maybe this and this, and it'll make it right. And then you get under the hood, and you're like, oh crap, there's a lot more here that needs to be fixed than I originally anticipated. I think RG3 was his get rich quick scheme that petered out very fast, and he said, all right, never mind. I got to buckle up. I got to make some long-term investments, and I'm really going to have to grind this thing out to make a winner here. So I don't think it was necessarily the worst decision to bring him in, but I think in all these guys, they know exactly what they have at this point. And if you're going to get someone hurt, I mean, it sounds really crappy, but it might as well be RG3 because your future is not tied to that guy. So let him go out there behind this line and run away from pressure every single play and save the kid, Cody Kessler, after all those concussions he's had this year.
Well, and in terms of escapability, nobody is better equipped to escape the rush than RG3 in this case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what originally their idea was, look, we can get a mobile quarterback. We're going to have the best line in the world, but we can move the pocket with him. I think that's what you heard with Hugh Jackson last week, said I haven't even scratched the surface of my bag of tricks or whatever the hell he said, something along those lines. I think that's what they're referring to, is that they haven't got a chance to unleash some of the stuff they probably wanted to do when they had these visions of Terrell Pryor, Josh Gordon, and Coleman on the outside, and RG3 with a moving pocket, and Duke Johnson flaring out of the backfield. All that stuff sounds really good, and probably, I still stand by, I think we'd all been pleasantly surprised with this offense had RG3 stayed healthy. But Craig, I mean, that's the gamble of all gambles to say if he stays healthy. The second he got hurt, we saw exactly what happened to this team. The whole thing went down the tubes, and now here we are at 0-4 and looking at an 0-16 season.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Will Burge from WTAM. You're on, Saturdays 3 to 6 in addition to many,
yep,
many other slots?
Yeah, Saturdays 3 to 6. I think that's what I have this week left. I believe that's it. Maybe I might have Sports Feed or something tomorrow night on Friday as well. But this Saturday, interesting, we'll actually be talking about the public square closure and whether or not to let RTA buses through Superior Avenue or to keep it as one unified green public space and actually block that street off permanently.
And that's actually not a simple debate. That's like a jousting match between city council and the mayor's office.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very contentious. I was at the city council meeting yesterday. A ton of passion, a ton of tempers flaring, angry riders there making their public hearing. And I actually presented a proposal of a compromise between the two that would allow for passing through RTA buses that don't have stops in the middle of public square to be able to use the pass through between just in the peak morning rush hours and the peak afternoon rush hours, and then closing it off the rest of the day with automatic bollards that rise up out of the ground. And people seem to like it, but even that still pissed off riders, because there's people who say, screw that, it's a street, we want buses on it. And the other side says, hey man, we want a big park to play in downtown, which is totally reasonable. It's something we need in the city to have a public space like that. So it is a very delicate debate, and we're going to have a bunch of different sides and viewpoints on it this Saturday. We want to talk about it on TAM.
All right. Well, very cool. We'll check that out. Thanks so much for your time, man. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Craig. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
All right. Until next time, everybody, it's been the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.